The Collegiate Council for the United Nations is proud to present a truly international citizen and international leader, Prime Minister Nehru of India.
Mr. Chairman, young friends, I'm not quite clear as to my particular function here today and what I am to talk to you about. I could, of course, talk to you about my country, what is happening there, what our hopes and aspirations are, and then probably I'd get lost in a mass of detail. I don't want to do that. Now, obviously, this gathering here of student leaders from a large number of states in America has, in my opinion, a special importance, presumably because you represent, well, the future of the United States and the future or present growing thinking of the United States. Now it seems to me, and this applies not to the United States but to every country in the world, that on the one side there is tremendous achievement and the world is changing rapidly in regard to technical matters, technological advances and material advancement. But probably the thinking of human beings has not kept pace with these changes that are taking place. What I mean is their thinking in regard to those particular advances may have kept pace. The engineer or whoever he is produces something new. But in relation to the larger scheme of life, that lags behind. In the old days, whether you take ancient Greece or ancient India or probably any developed country in the ancient times, you see the technical apparatus of civilization was rather backward, very backward. But human thought was not backward. Now, you wouldn't say today, for instance, now Plato lived in an age which was technologically a backward age, but he was a very great man. An engine driver or somebody like that now is technically much more efficient, but nobody would call him a greater person than Plato. Therefore, there was something essentially in Plato, and I mention one name because you probably know that name. I could mention many names in India like that with whom you are presumably not acquainted. That is, there's something which the quality of thought, or call it what you like, which made Plato great. Now, it appears that in spite of our tremendous advancement in science, technology, etc., we have not advanced in that quality of thought, and hence perhaps the difficulties that we face, because we face the technological world of today with the thinking of a past age, or at any rate the thinking has not caught up to these changes. It will have to catch up unless there is disaster on a big scale. And how to do that is a problem. And your generation will have to face that problem more than my generation. Because after all, my generation is a generation which is a passing one. And I take no credit for my generation. It has achieved much. I'm talking in a world sense, not of India. It has achieved much, no doubt. But it has not got itself out of the ruts of old thinking and cannot easily adapt itself to this new age in which we live. As a matter of fact, even national frontiers in this jet age are rather out of date. They don't fit in. Now, I'm not proposing that national frontiers should be abolished, but I have no doubt that the tendency will be in that direction. You have to fit in with modern developments. You are thinking in terms of space travel today. What has space travel got to do with the many petty problems that even come up before the United Nations here? Petty national conflicts, they have no relation, they belong to some other world. And so we have this conflict of the old world, so far as our thinking is concerned, and the new actual world with which we have to deal because of these technological changes and improvements and the space age and whatnot. And unless that gap is bridged, there will be trouble, bound to be. And it's up to you who are going to enter, well, life in its active phases now, to try to bridge that gap and to bring about this new thinking as to how to bridge that gap. Well, I can't advise you about that. Nobody can. You have to evolve that. Every country has to evolve it and to help each other to do so. Of course, you will do so, subject always to one major premise, that you and I are not destroyed in the meantime by nuclear war or something like that. Well then, I do not know who will be quite left over to develop a new thought, because probably then the material advances that civilization has achieved will themselves be destroyed. So that we have to face these two problems. One is just to avoid destruction on a large scale by war. And secondly, that is a more basic problem, how to bring up our thinking in line with the developing modern age. And you in America represent more than any other country this developed, mature, modern age of technological advance. And it's up to you, therefore, to catch up to it in your thinking too. Not in that limited thinking which might be technical or technological, that of course is going ahead, but in the wider concept of life, some kind of philosophy governing life. We read old books. Take a man like Emerson, not Emerson, I'm sorry. No, I've got mixed up. That old Dutch philosopher, I was thinking. Erasmus, that's it. I'm sorry, I got mixed up. Well, Erasmus, I'm told, had a library of 20 or 30 volumes altogether. Maybe might have read a few more books too. And yet he was a very able, a very wise man, with what might be called an integrated view of life. Now, if we read hundreds or thousands of books, skip through them or read them, and we forget them, many of them, after we read them. Our life becomes more and more superficial, and we possibly seldom have even time to think about anything deeper than the normal superficial experiences of life. I'm not talking in high terms of spirituality or religion. I do not call myself exactly a man of religion. But I do hope that I am not devoid of something which might, well, in a sense be called spiritual. Not any dogma, but a certain approach. Now we lose that progressively. And even our religions become more superficial, more observances, more ritual than deep thinking, which would give poise to our lives. Now how are we to develop that? That is a problem. I put it to you. I can't tell you how to do it. But ultimately, unless you do that, you will be left far behind in your thinking, behind the technological improvements that you yourselves bring about. The immediate problem, of course, is a very immediate one about the possibility of war and how to avoid that. Now, it is an extraordinary thing that every country, so far as I know, shouts loudly against war. Every people not only shout but feel deeply and naturally that there should be no war and that they should not be destroyed. You, young men and young women gathered here, I have no doubt, none of you has any particular desire to be bombed out quickly. I mean, you want to survive, you want to experience life and do all manner of things that you may have in your heads. Now, we all think that everywhere in the world, and yet, by some peculiar destiny, or call it what you will, we are driven step by step towards the possibility of war. I don't say that war would happen, I hope not. But we are driven in that direction, and no one quite knows what to do to prevent it. It's an extraordinary state of affairs. And it's bad enough. It must have been bad enough in the old days when autocratic rulers controlled the destinies of nations and peoples. But the odd thing is that in these days of democracy, even there, we are helpless in avoiding these, we appear to be helpless in avoiding these major catastrophes. I am quite sure that there is far more of common urges and common thinking and common objectives in the world than ever before. But in spite of that, they don't take shape in common action. Our publicity organs, which are very powerful today, whether it is the press or the radio or television or whatever it may be, naturally and almost automatically bring out and give publicity to the shady aspects of life. Because the shady aspects appear to be news. If a person lives a normal, cooperative, good life, it is no news. But if he commits a crime, a murder, it is news. And it's given big headlines. So also in international affairs, the enormous amount of cooperation that exists between nations, and even between nations that are apparently hostile to each other, even between, let us say, the United States and the Soviet Union, there's a vast field of common effort going on. Nobody knows much about it, but every little speech containing an element of threat or attack gets the greatest publicity, and one would think that peoples and countries and governments are constantly on the verge of war. So we get a very lopsided view of the world. I don't quite know how that can be avoided in the present context, except by laying stress on the other side too. Now, I have no magic remedy for all this. I'm merely pointing out to you some of the problems which you must face. Everybody faces. To some extent, your responsibility in the United States, young men and young women here, is perhaps greater, because the responsibility of the United States itself is greater in world affairs. It has come to it by virtue of its own growth, development, power. And there's an odd thing about getting all this power. It is a sign of achievement. But when a country becomes very powerful, it has to be very careful not to throw about its power. That's just like an individual. And not to incite the envy of others too much. That's not its fault, but there it is. And reaction of great affluence on other people's who are relatively poor is not a good reaction. So you function in somewhat difficult circumstances by very virtue of your great power and affluence. It slightly colors the vision of other people in the rest of the world in regard to you. It's odd. I mean, they admire you, they want to learn from you, they want to copy many things from here and all that. And yet, in the subconscious self, there's a certain resentment that you are much better off than they are. I suppose so. I'm really talking about things I know nothing about. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I think it is so. So, you have this tremendous responsibility and opportunity. You will work in the United States, you will spread out in other countries. Also, there is a tendency for Americans, not of the younger generation but others, to judge every other country and every other people by a certain yardstick of their own fashioning in their own country. This to some extent is natural perhaps, but obviously countries differ. The first lesson we should all learn is that there is tremendous variety in this world, national variety and all kinds of climatic variety, geographical variety, linguistic variety, all these varieties in this world which make the world a much richer place to live in, much more exciting place than it was all fashioned after some uniform way. Now, because you live in a great big country and a great country, you tend to expect other countries to be like yours, or to iterate, to want to be like yours. It doesn't necessarily follow that they should want that. They may prefer their own ways, they may prefer their own language, their own food, whatever it is, small things and big things. In India we have that problem on a smaller scale. India is a big country with great variety, and we want to preserve that variety. We don't want to make India some uniform throughout the land, but at the same time obviously we want to have, and we have and have had, a basic unity which has bound India together. Sometimes we lay great stress on this unity because as the people rise, become more conscious in various ways, politically and otherwise, the variety gains greater prominence. We want both the variety and the unity. And in the same way we want, I hope, to maintain the great variety of the world and at the same time develop a basic unity in the world too. So, here in the United States, there is variety, of course, but possibly you have developed a greater sense of uniformity here, chiefly because of your industrial development. That does bring that about, and that is bound to affect the rest of the world too, because the means of communication become swifter and swifter. Well, that's all right, natural changes. So, here is this major problem of the age. We have achieved, through our progress in science and technology, a state of affairs when, on the material plane, we can solve every problem of the world. We can give a standard of living to every single person in the world, not terribly high, but certainly much higher than it is today, and certainly provide for the basic necessities of the people. Remember, your problems in America are many, but they do not concern what might be called the basic necessities of the people. In India, our problem is the basic necessities for people to have enough food, clothing, houses, education, health services, and the like. And we can hardly think in big terms about other luxuries and others. In fact, we don't encourage luxuries, because we do not want our country, small groups in our country, to indulge in luxuries while the great mass of the population are denied the primary necessities. It's vulgar, apart from everything else. So the problems differ. But now, I have no doubt that you can prove almost mathematically that with the world's resources, the people, all the people of the world, can, in the course of a relatively short period of time, be provided with these primary necessities. And then naturally they'll grow more. And yet, in spite of this fact becoming evident for the first time in history, because this was not so previously, the resources of the world were not enough for the people. And we had therefore the old system, the rich landlords, the poor serfs of the landlords, and this kind of distinction, because there was really not enough to go around. Now there is, or can be enough to go around. And when we are on the verge of the solution of these world, of these problems which have existed throughout history, we get entangled in this question of war and peace and the possibility of total destruction of the civilization that man has built up. It's an extraordinary paradox. And more especially so when one realizes that nobody wants to be destroyed. Why should anybody want to be destroyed? And yet, we function. I mean, say our minds are so conditioned that we function in a way which leads in that direction of possible disaster. Well, you perhaps know that in the preamble, I think, of the UNESCO organization, there occurs that wars begin in the minds of men, which is perfectly true. In a sense, everything begins in the minds of men. And the new method of approach to peace, approach to the removal of causes of conflict, must come out of the minds of men. And one has to aim deliberately at that, not accidentally. There are racial problems, there are problems just of poverty. These are basic problems which apply to all the world. And so, I suggest to you, who occupy leading positions in the student communities of this great country, deliberately to apply your thinking in this direction. And try to find out, there may be not one remedy, but many, or many parallel approaches to attain the same objective. It doesn't matter. The point is that the general direction should be the same, and there should be an urge to get over this present-day malady of civilization, that is, the possibility of recurring wars. Now it is not even a question of recurring wars, because scientists tell us that if another war, big war, comes, well, there will be no recurrence for a long, long time. I think Einstein said that the war after the next war would be fought with bows and arrows. That's a vivid way of describing how civilization will go back to the bow and arrow stage and gradually perhaps develop or not develop. Well, it's no good my going on and taking up your time. I think it's far better if I deal with some of your questions and we can come to some concrete subjects.